A dream. You dreamt you wrote something so good, so ambivalent and destructive, so creative, so lacking in morals or decency or instruction, so sad and so funny, so useless and old, so familiar and new, so full of theft and power, that they had to name a god after it. When you woke, the page of your mind was bare, and the world was changed.
About Time, Poems by David Duchovny, is his seventh and first poetic work, which covers a range of intimate themes and topics, including love, the loss of love, parenting, Duchovny's own parents' alienation, and other emotional quandaries. On display is an insightful and clever play of words that distill to an emotionally impactful portrayal of what the author and actor holds most dear. The company's efforts at achieving such clarity range in this collection from laser-sharp single-sentence poems to emotionally sweeping ruminations.
Evergreen. The ancient mother sleeps not 5 miles away in a worry of dreams. She shudders over all times except the present. Unknown to herself, her body irksome, a source of no pleasures, only pains. Her skin thin and raw, slack her breath and dry. And yet her shame shades the dying shoots of my love, hoarding the sun and rain, and is in me evergreen.
David Duchovny is an award-winning actor, director, New York Times bestselling author of several novels, singer, songwriter, and host of the podcast Fail Better. It is a great pleasure to welcome him back to the roundtable. Hello, David Duchovny. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm good.
You talk a little bit about this in the introduction, but it seems as though in one way, shape, or form, poetry has always been a part of your life.
That's true. I always come back to something that James Joyce said, which is that every word is a novel. And by that, he means, you know, the way that a word takes its journey through language over time, how it changes meaning. And that kind of slippery sense of words or the inability to pin a word down has always been a source of curiosity for me and my interrogation of how we communicate with these slippery things we call words and just the fascination with their journey and with the kind of oblique knowledge that they can throw off in their slipperiness, in the fact that we can't quite get a handle on exactly what we mean when we're using them.
How does it help you convey the message that you want in using this particular form?
That's the question, the good question, because you use the phrase convey the message. I don't have a message to convey in poetry. That's kind of what I say in the introduction, is like, poetry might be the last place where you don't have to convey a message. You're conveying a feeling. You're conveying a sense. You're conveying, in many ways, a sense of an inability to have a message, an inability to identify your message literally. That's what a poem is. And that's what I value in a poem, is actually not having a message, but having a sense or a feeling, or an irritation, or an inspiration. So that's how I'd answer that.
But there can be a story there that is,
yes,
conveyed.
Sure. Yeah, and there are some of these poems do kind of take place in an event. Not many of them. The event in most of these poems is just an idea, or like I said, a sense or a feeling. But there are a couple where, you know, there are identifiable people walking in an identifiable world and seeing identifiable things in that world.
You start this off in a very honest way of saying, I know what you're thinking, just what the world needs, a bunch of poems from an actor. Did that ever keep you from actually pursuing wanting to share these with others?
No, because I think that's you know what, I'm kind of attacking a straw man at that point, because I know it's a kind of a gross generalization that actors, if they don't have anything to say, at least they should also just stay out of, you know, politics and things like that. So it's just kind of making fun of myself as being in a profession where, like anybody else, people want their opinions known and they want their thoughts known, but actors have a bigger megaphone, so they get taken to task for using that.
You also talk in the introduction. He was one of my favorite guests. We had him on three, four, five. Well, we had him on whenever we could get him on, and that was Harold Bloom.
Oh,
You studied with Harold Bloom at Yale. What do you learn from someone like that who is it just seems to just sweat knowledge? I've never seen anything like that.
Neither have I. I mean, he was a unique individual in that way. I think he had a photographic memory. He could recite pages and pages of poetry, and one got the sense being near him that he was just a walking library, and not a small library, a walking library of the Western canon, really, and more. I mean, sitting in his classes were revelatory, and that's one of the, I refer to one of the things that he mentioned in just one class, and it stayed with me. There are many things he's mentioned just in passing that stayed with me. He was able to make, you can always attack a generalization because it's a generalization, but he was able to make generalizations because he knew the general knowledge. He knew it all.
You quote in the book of what he taught you about fame, what he told you about fame.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, he had said at some point in a class that we were the offspring, as we are, of two different cultures, the Judaic culture that informs the Old Testament and obviously the New Testament, and the Greek culture, which informs our culture, our stories, our storytelling, our mythologies, and that these two cultures had opposite notions of what fame or eternal life was. And in the Greek version, it was what he called horizontal, which was to be known in the present moment, far and wide across the world. And the Hebrew notion was to be known vertically in the present moment and in the future, not necessarily as a famous person of today, but to be known to future generations.
How does poetry fit into your life in the sense of is it a practice that you sit down and say, I am going to work on this, or is it something that is that comes when it comes and there are moments and then there are moments where it is not as front and center in your life?
Yeah, all those things. It comes when it comes. I'm lucky enough not to be able to make a living as a poet. So I don't have to write a poem every day, or I don't have to continue to publish poems. So it's kind of a luxury that I have that I can wait until an idea arises. And in that way, it's a real pleasure for me, because it just happens when it happens. But I'll have an idea or a turn of phrase or something, and I'll just think, oh, that's worthwhile to pursue it. And that's usually when a poem happens, if I think of pursuing something.
And in that pursuit, I'm curious as to how long, what goes into it, that pursuit of there's the idea and then there's the actual work, the real work of it, right?
Yeah, there's the initial inspiration and the kind of, not the vomiting out, but the quick, Wordsworth calls it a spontaneous overflow of powerful feeling, recollected in tranquility. So it's that initial spontaneous overflow. And then later on is the tranquility of, okay, I got this thing out there, or I tried to get this thing out there. Now, how do I shape it without killing it? How do I shape it and stay true to the improvisational way that it came out, the poetic way that it came out?
You use the word improvisational. Is that how it should come out in your mind?
I don't know about should, but that's how it comes out for me. because I don't try to be intentionally clear. I'm just trying to almost a sense, if I'm going to write a letter to somebody and tell them about my life, I'm going to try and be as clear as possible. But if I'm writing a poem, what I'm trying to say is not clear in my mind. It's more of a feeling. It's more of an irritation, like I've said before. And so I allow the words to shadow, to shade, rather than try to be literal or directly communicative, if that makes any sense.
And what's fascinating about the book, I alluded to this in the introduction, the subject matters are varied. One poem, Confessions of a Pet Rock.
I am not lazy or useless or anyone's pet anything. I am merely other. I didn't want more than to sit in my wordless being, my utter isness. But if offered, I might have accepted another fate, thrown through that glass window, say, shattering into a new dimension, on the street alone, undomesticated by my fall, dallying on my brother, the asphalt, waiting for another hand to lend me the will, momentarily to raise me up in the face of my nemesis, captor, and lover, gravity, which is my genius, waiting. Then may be used in a crime, say, and called upon as witness to the all-consuming play of your silly dramas, a rock of importance. Ah, well, no regrets for me. If only you could have slowed down to my time, geologic, the marking of years as milliseconds, slower even than the evolutionary swell of ocean vowels or the languid language of trees. You might have learned something. You might have learned the joke is on you.
There are a lot of different things in here that are fascinating, but I would assume for you, looking back, different from us, the reader, are of whatever moment you are in that starts the process.
That's exactly right. And the poems represent probably 30 years of writing poems, or 25 at least. So they're it's not a concept album in the sense that Tommy by The Who is a concept album. It's the only through line would be me writing through time, and that's I think why I call it About Time. So there's in my mind there's very little kind of connection between me 30 years ago and me today. And when I look back, when I started to put the volume together and I had these older poems that I was looking at, I did think about, well, now I wouldn't write it that way. Now I'd like to maybe rewrite that. And I did some of that, but at some point I just decided I was rewriting somebody else's poems. And I had to kind of honor what I had done. It's very interesting. I'm not comparing myself to Whitman, but when you think about a poet like Whitman, there's a guy who rewrote his poems his whole life, and
Constantly, right.
it's fascinating to think of that. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't feel like, at least in this point, I didn't want to try to rewrite something that I had written that long ago.
But it's also a Polaroid of that time. I mean,
Exactly.
it's different otherwise, right?
I can't get back there. That's kind of the point is I could try. I mean, I can attack it linguistically or stylistically. I can replace a word here and there, but I'm not going to know honestly what I thought I was doing back then.
David Duchovny is our guest. The new poetry collection is About Time. It is published by Akashic Books. Your father looms large in this work, and as does family and familiar relationships. And again, I assume that comes with where you are in your life and what you're thinking of, and let's face it, of what gets us here in the first place.
That's exactly right. I mean, these poems kind of represent an attempt to stop time, I think. Poems, if they're decent, can slow down time. They make you sit down in the words. It's not just, as we said in the beginning, it's not just figuring out what this person is trying to tell me, the message of it, but it's more of a haze of words around a thing. So it's me trying to sit down in whatever discomfort, because usually it's discomfort. And by discomfort, I just don't mean negative discomfort. It can be positive discomfort. It can be an excess of joy. It can be an excess of sorrow. But it's an excess of something. It's powerful. And I want to sit down in it and dig deeper into it. And a poem can be a way of me trying to slow myself down into this discomfort.
In that discomfort, is the word choice part of that? And I know we talked about this, but the conveying of that feeling that you have of the words that will do that, the justice that you want it to do.
Yeah. Yes, because I'm aware that this discomfort is not worded. That's one of the things that leads me to write it as a poem. And so I'm aware that the words I'm going to find, it's kind of like, it's like when you used to, as a kid, you'd get a leaf and you'd put it in a book and you'd like rub a graphite pencil over the page, and you'd have the outline of the leaf. So I think of the poem as an outline of this thing that can't be said. Otherwise, I just say it. So it can't be said, and I can only outline it. And the words are just that pencil tracing over it. So the word choice is not trying to be too specific or too literal. It's actually trying to outline it or to, I think about, like, I studied physics for poets when I was in school, because I'm not smart enough at science to really get through the science requirement. And they had this bogus course called Physics for Poets for people, liberal arts people like me, to get their science requirement. And we studied neutrinos in that. And it's been great that I got that in my head, because a neutrino is a particle that we cannot see except in its reaction to other particles. We only know that a neutrino has been there because we see a reaction in other particles that we can measure. So that's the way I think of writing a poem, is I can't see exactly what I'm trying to say, but I can start to see the outline of it in the reaction of the words that I'm getting on the page. If that makes sense.
It does make sense. I was in the introduction again, I mentioned your working as a singer-songwriter, and and you write about this in the introduction about the difference between writing a song, writing a lyric, and writing a poem. And you write, a great lyric is not a great poem, and yet lyrics have the undeniable merit of necessary restraint, the gorgeous limitations and humility of the form. You say earlier, in a poem, the words are the words and the music.
Yeah.
So those are pursuits that I assume you take on, that you never said, I was going to try to, for want of a better term, kill two birds with one stone. These were always going to be separate pursuits.
Yeah, they are. I've never tried to set a poem to music. I don't write the poems melodically in that way. When you're writing a lyric, you have a certain amount of feet of the melody that you've got to fit it into. And there's a lot of different words that don't sound good when sung. So you're limited by that. You're limited by rhyme. I think back to the old forms in literature that poets used to write in, whether it was just the iambic pentameter free verse of Shakespeare, or sonnets, villanelles, all these forms. And I don't write in those, but I do I see them more as lyrics, because they force you into a box, and it's your cleverness that has to work within that box. And sometimes having a limit or having a rule that you've got to write around it points you in certain directions and it makes you make connections that you might not go to logically. It's like, I've only got two syllables here to end this line, so I can't use any three, four, five syllable words. I'm forced to use this two syllable word that I've got to find now. And that can actually make your thinking process less logical and more poetic. And I think sometimes in lyrics we get that. And sometimes when we use strict form in poetry, we can be led to choices that we wouldn't get without that kind of discipline.
I know I've spoken to Billy Collins about this, but how front and center or where in the equation, if at all, is the reader?
I think that comes, at least for me, when I start to write, I'm not thinking of the reader. I think that comes maybe in the second kind of revision stage. Also, tonally, it can change if I start to think about a reader in a good way or a bad way. I can st if I start to think about a reader, I might hide more, in the
Mm.
beginning. I might make that decision later to hide more. I might not ever make that decision to hide. So, no, I don't. I actually don't think of the reader, and I think that's a really good question. I've never thought of thinking of the reader, actually.
Another way of putting it too is, do you want the poem by a reader to be understood, to have whatever your what you want to convey, again with a feeling, that is matched? Or if a reader comes out and says, I don't get what that is about, that that's okay.
That's okay, but I really like to be misunderstood. If I could have that, but the emphasis is on understood. Like a misunderstanding of a poem is just as legitimate as an understanding of a poem. So I think of once, you asked me if I think of the reader. Once I finish a poem, once I put a poem out there, all I think about is the reader. That's all that matters anymore. Like, I no longer matter once I have published that poem. What I think it is, what I think it means, none of that matters. It just matters how it's understood or misunderstood.
So another way to ask that question is, now that About Time is out and in the hands of readers, what would you like them to experience?
What would I like them to misunderstand?
Yes.
Well, it's just, I guess, it depends on the poem. There's different kind of valences in this book. Some of them are elegiac and mournful. A lot of them are. Some deal with death and loss of love. And these are things that we all have in our lives. So that's why I'm confident that even if exactly what I'm trying to get at is misunderstood, the overall tenor of the poems, I think, is strong enough to get a really good misunderstanding out of somebody and to get a sense in which, not that they understand what I was trying to say, but that it's giving voice to something that they might have said or that they have wanted to say.
David Duchovny's new collection is About Time. It is published by Akashic Books. It is such a smart and moving collection. David, I thank you so much for your time. I thank so much for your thoughtfulness, and it's a great pleasure to speak to you and have you on the program this morning.
Well, it's a real pleasure to talk about the book with somebody that appreciates poetry and can speak about it in the way that you do. So I appreciate that as well.
High five the sky. When everything is permitted, our dreams will cease in the bright daylight of lukewarm acceptance. Sleep becomes impossible. Shadows, a thing of the past, replaced by shallows. Lighter still, we have traded something away that remains to be seen. And we will wander the easy streets, high-fiving the sky imbecilically, unbeknownst to ourselves, mourning wanly the Badlands, our old mythic difficulty. We cannot know how good for us the bad times were.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.